Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Rebag, your premier destination for luxury resale. Elevate your style with our curated collection of bags, watches, and fine jewelry. At Rebag, quality is our priority. Each piece meticulously vetted and verified by experts, ensuring your investment is nothing short of perfection. Buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Hermès, Chanel, and Cartier. Access expertly crafted and hard-to-find pieces that redefine luxury. Your next investment awaits at Rebag. Get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. That's 10% off the luxury you deserve. Don't miss out. Head to Rebag.com and enter code REBAG10 at checkout. That's REBAG10.
An Erio's original.
Each week, we decide who's to blame for a historical tragedy. And each week, you tell us if we got it right. My name is Rebecca Delgado-Smith, and this is The Aftermath. The Aftermath. Hey everyone, thanks for tuning into this episode of The Aftermath. Today we're speaking with Dr. Gregory Smits. Dr. Smits is a professor of history and Asian studies at Pennsylvania State University. He is a social and cultural historian of Japan, and he's the author of two studies of Japanese earthquakes: When the Earth Roars, Lessons from the History of Earthquakes in Japan, and Seismic Japan, The Long History and Continuing Legacy of the Ansai Edo Earthquakes. Let's hear what he has to say about the Great Kanto Earthquake. Hi, Greg. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Hi, Rebecca. I'm so happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
So could you start off by giving us some context on the state of Japan in the 1920s before the earthquake? What was the jazz era? How was Japan growing and expanding?
Yes. Japan in the 1920s was undergoing, of course, societies always change, but, you know, some societies change faster at certain times. And this was a time of especially rapid change in Japan. In approximately 1918, it had become majority urban. That was the result of World War One. And that urbanizing trend continued pretty much from 1918 all the way to the present day. And so cities were growing rapidly vis-a-vis the countryside, and all of the enticements of cities, you know, the downside was factory work that was really, demanding for people who didn't have skills, and all that kind of misery of an industrial society. But on the other hand, a middle class was steadily growing, average income was increasing, and cities were getting an influx of low-cost food, for example, from Japan's colonies, which were out there, Korea being especially important in what we're about to talk about. And so there was a discourse that developed that was highly critical of what was happening in society, critical of gender roles being disrupted. There's a great deal of concern with that, that women were cutting their hair short. That was always the ultimate symbol of problems in society. And it's sort of tame compared to today, but you know, women were cutting their hair shorts and sometimes going out and getting jobs in restaurants or cafes. And people were idling around, you know, in their leisure time and spending inordinate amounts of money on recreation, such as theater and things like that. All things that are very tame by today's standards, but these were signs by many social commentators that things were not right with the world. And I should also add for a broader context that throughout the whole world, there was an anxiety about modernity at right about this time. In the United States, for example, there was all sorts of concern about what had caused World War I and what sorts of social forces were at work behind this sort of thing. And, you know, the so-called monkey trial was about going to happen in 1925. So this is not just Japan, but all over the world, there's a sort of anxiety about many of the aspects of modernity that were in full motion at the time.
So in terms of the buildings in Japan, how sturdy was the construction of the buildings in Tokyo at the time?
All right. They in general, they weren't very sturdy. Now, that said, there were exceptions. And one of the things that comes out of this earthquake is there really isn't any advancement in seismology that comes out of this earthquake. Some earthquakes do cause that, but this one didn't. But it did cause a change in building construction, namely the use of reinforced concrete. And so people noted when the dust had settled that reinforced concrete structures did very well. Mm. But most structures were wooden. And wooden structures actually do very well to a point in earthquakes. In fact, there's flexibility in them. So like in California, that's a very good thing is to have a wooden structure as long as it's really well anchored to the foundation. But all this wood, and then combined with the timing of the earthquake at just before noon, when people were cooking, plus other structural problems like gas mains that had been hastily installed since the 1880s and 90s, water mains that were old and made of clay pipes that quickly broke. And all this combined to cause massive fires in a very short time. So basically the building of Tokyo was almost ideally suited for a disaster to cause the worst possible disaster from an earthquake.
Perhaps you can walk us through how it all went down that afternoon. What happened first? How was the initial shock? And then what proceeded after that?
Okay, so based on various kinds of eyewitness accounts, and some of the most useful are actually from ship's captains who were in the harbor. And so the ship was fine. I mean, there's some waves and so forth. But they could notice and get a sense of the rough timing of things. And so based on accounts like this, the earthquake occurred at 2 minutes before noon, and there was heavy shaking. The epicenter was nearby in the Sagami Bay area, and it was a megathrust earthquake. In other words, it generated a tsunami. The tsunami in Tokyo was not really an important factor. The important factor was the shaking, which broke gas lines, turned over cooking fires, and broke water mains. And so fires began to be noticed within 1 minute of the cessation of shaking. The many accounts noted that within, like, for example, looking at it from Tokyo Bay or from Yokohama, within 20 minutes to 30 minutes, it looked like the entire city was on fire.
Wow.
So we have fires shooting up within a minute or two and complete conflagration within 20 to 30 minutes.
So what were these fire tornadoes that I've read about? Are these an anomaly to this earthquake, or does this happen after earthquakes? Is this common?
it's not common, but it could happen depending on circumstances. And it's essentially the creation of a furnace such that the flames are so intense and there's so much fuel that it creates a kind of vortex. It sucks in material into the fire, which then burns it up, and you know the hot air rises, thus sucking in more material. So it's like a kind of a vortex. So one of the reasons for this was the weather was hot, dry, and actually very windy, because not in Tokyo itself, but nearby off the coast were some typhoons. So they were kicking up heavy winds. And so the combination of broken gas mains, no water to fight the fire, lots of wood, and dry, heavy winds is what came together to cause this furnace-like atmosphere. It's very much like you might have heard of the fire bombings of Tokyo toward the end of World War II, created very similar effects, where the rivers would boil from the heat, things and people would explode just from the sheer heat. It wasn't quite that intense in 1923, but very similar kinds of effects were going on.
Wow. I had not heard of those.
Yeah. To give one example, that many people died in part because they were trying to flee, and the roads turned into a kind of tar, and they got stuck in the roadway material, because of the heat.
That sounds absolutely terrible. I believe that also a large portion of the death toll took place inside one department store. Can you explain to us what happened there?
Yes. It probably wasn't a department store. It was the word depot. So it was the Army Clothing Depot, right? So that happened to be a very large open area, just kind of a big open flat area, where it was being used as a warehouse for Army clothing. And it's fairly close to the middle of town. And so it's the largest open area, in the, downtown Tokyo. And as these firestorms start popping up in different parts of town, people are naturally tending to flee to this open area. One other thing I should mention in this context is that parks were very few in number and very narrow. So there weren't a lot of open areas. That was another problem with Tokyo at the time. And so this was the idea. It made sense. Let's flee and take all carrying all your belongings that you can carry. We're going to flee into this open area that can accommodate tens of thousands of people if they pack in. It seemed reasonable to the people at the time, but unfortunately, the entire area, the entire depot became engulfed. The firestorm just headed toward it. And by the time people realized that this was not a good place to be, there was really no way to escape. If you were at the edge, which way do you run? If you were in the middle, you couldn't run. You were just packed in there. Some people did survive simply by virtue of being at the bottom of a pile of human bodies. But essentially, approximately 38,000 people died there, and many of them were burned beyond recognition. It was, you can actually see photos of this if you Google for them, at least photos of the aftermath.
Wow. So. Now, you mentioned the tsunamis briefly. Were there tsunamis, and where did they take place? How did they, form, manifest?
Yes. So this earthquake was caused by the rupture of a subduction zone along the Philippine and Okhotsk plates. And the typical scenario is that friction has locked the fault. And then when it finally does rupture, one of the slabs does this. It's kind of this kind of motion that throws off water if it happens at the right speed. If it's too slow, it doesn't happen, and for other reasons, it might not. So not every megathrust earthquake generates a tsunami, but most of them do. And this one did. The tsunami was about 10 meters or 33 feet, and it inundated areas a little bit south of Tokyo in the Sagami Bay area. And it did cause, many estimates are that it washed away about 500,000 homes and structures. We're not quite sure how many people it killed, but thousands. So it was very disruptive, although not in Tokyo itself, but just a little bit to the south.
So after the quake, people turned against the Korean immigrant community. Now, what happened? Why? What is the history between the Japanese and Koreans at the time?
Okay, so Korea became a colony of Japan, and you can, there are two dates you could give for that, either 1905 or 1910, depending on exactly how you define it. But anyway, since 1910 for sure. And so for the last 13 or more years, Korea has been a colony of Japan. And in that context, Koreans had been coming over into Japan's cities, Osaka and Tokyo especially, to work in the factories. So this is part of this urbanization I described earlier. There were demands for unskilled factory laborers, ideally, you know, from the factory owner's point of view, the lower the wages, the better. And so Korean laborers were willing to work at lower wages than Japanese laborers. So there had been, by 1923, fairly large Korean immigrant communities in Japan. Now, strictly speaking, they are in some sense Japanese, you know, because of the colonizing. But of course, culturally and in many other ways, they were distinct. And so that's the Korean community. And there was a sense on the part of many Japanese that Koreans in general did not like Japan and Japanese because, you know, they'd been colonized. Moreover, there was a Korean independence movement that had developed in Korea, and it was had burst forth in the early 1920s. So this was very much in the newspapers and so forth. So that's one factor. The other big factor is just the fact, just as you were surprised at the extent of the devastation by fire, so too many people in Tokyo thought, well, there's no way that an earthquake could cause this degree of fire damage. And so rumors spread that Koreans had lighted fires, you know, in the wake of the confusion of the earthquake, or were poisoning wells so that, you know, to hamper the relief situation, or that in the wake of the earthquake and the fires, that Koreans were taking advantage of that to loot or to rob people and things like that. I have actually looked at the newspapers of this time and found, and, you know, very big, you know, not the front page headlines, but second page type headlines of newspapers actually spreading these rumors, not necessarily endorsing them wholeheartedly, but by saying, we have heard, and then you get all these kinds of accounts. So that was the context for vigilante violence against Koreans or people imagined to possibly be Koreans. So the usual way that these vigilante gangs would identify people as Korean was by asking them to say something that would, if your native language was Korean, it would be very difficult to say. But also there were people in Tokyo from all over the world who looked Asian, right? So there were people from China, at least roughly 100, we think, if not more. Died from these vigilante gangs because they were asked to say this and they couldn't say it or couldn't say it in Tokyo accented Japanese. There were also people with speech impediments in two or three cases, people from outlying areas of Japan that had very strong local accents. Indeed, the seismologist who's most famous, well, there are two of them, but one of the two seismologists, he was credited for predicting this earthquake, even though he didn't. No one can predict earthquakes, and he didn't. But Akitsune, Imamura Akitsune, or Akitsune Imamura, if you say in the Western order, he was from Kagoshima Prefecture, way down in the south. And I used to live there too, and there's a very distinct accent even to this day. And so he was detained by one of these gangs, and he was nervous for a little while because they were very suspicious of him. But he did you know, manage to come out okay. So yeah, according to the government at the time, they gave the ridiculously low figure of roughly 130 Koreans had died, unfortunately, in, you know, they didn't call it vigilante violence, but they used some term. And we'll never know how many, but the estimates, the lower end estimates are 6,000.
Wow.
Higher end estimates will go as high as 10,000. But I would say it's safe to say at least 6,000 entirely innocent people, mostly Korean, but some Chinese and others died from vigilante violence.
So, I mean, we talk a lot about tragedies on this podcast. Were there any stories that you know about survival from this event, and how did those that survive manage to do it?
Yeah, there are many stories. And in fact, the Boy Scouts and other kind of quasi-public agencies actually compiled stories after the earthquake in the spirit of, you know, kind of glorifying the resilience of the population and things like that. I have actually read so many that they all kind of blur together in my mind. But there are many stories of children, for example, separated from their parents, and then who eventually, well, in some cases, eventually get reunited, or more tragically, that find that one or both of their parents are perished, or vice versa. There was no particular thing that one would do in this earthquake to survive. In other words, there was no particular strategy. It was just sort of local situation. The building is crashing down around me. I stood in the door frame and I was okay. Or I ran out in the street just as the building was crashing. The survival stories are of that type. Or in this conflagration in the clothing depot, it was a case of, I just, you know, hunkered down, and then an hour or two later, I realized I was still alive and kind of clawed my way out of the debris and the bodies and, you know, found that I was alive.
What was the rebuilding effort like after the earthquake?
All right. Yeah, now that's, as you can imagine, soon after the earthquake, the politicians like the mayor of Tokyo and the prime minister and so forth said, well, this was awful, but this is an opportunity to create a greater Tokyo and a greater Japan, both, you know, physically and spiritually. But as far as the physical went, it's an opportunity to rationalize Tokyo, to take these narrow crisscrossing streets and irregular sized lots and to make them into nice straight streets, wider than before, with nice square, regularly, you know, shaped lots, larger parks, and a system where the parks are interconnected if possible, better schools and other public facilities that can also be used as places to which people could flee in times of disaster. So a tremendous, ambitious plan came forth, you know, within about a year or two of the earthquake. And it looked great, but of course, it's expensive. And there are other issues, like people don't necessarily want their land to be squared off, especially if they're going to lose some of their land. So, you know, to what extent does the government compensate people for lost land? Once you start to get into the details, it becomes very expensive. And so, and then, of course, also as time goes by, people are less likely to want to sacrifice for this great vision. So the result was that by roughly 1931 or two, the rebuilding was complete. So it took a little bit, like around 8 years. And the result was for sure a better Tokyo. All these things, more parks, wider streets, some rationalization of the land and so forth, but not nearly as much as the original plan. So it was, in the end, a compromise.
Now, how has Japan's location on the Ring of Fire affected its history and culture?
Okay, yeah. So Japan is at the intersection of four different tectonic plates, several of which are subducting, so that one is going under the other, which creates the conditions for earthquakes that generate significant tsunamis. And of course, this has been the case ever since human beings were living in Japan. So you can find people who make a big deal of this and like to come up with theories about Japanese culture based on disasters. There's a kind of an industry of theorizing about Japanese culture, which I think often goes too far, no matter what approach they take. So this is definitely a factor. And in coastal areas or any area that's subject to tsunami, for example, the local people who live there quickly figured out that you should, if there's an earthquake, you should run for the hills. And this would have been passed down simply in local lore. However, in the modern era, people started moving around, especially moving to big cities. And a lot of this local lore was forgotten or just not quite there. And then there are also the randomness of earthquakes. They don't occur regularly. Now, of course, we can go back to all the records and notice when there was one in human historical time, which is just minuscule compared to geological time. And, add them up and average them and come up with a recurrence interval. But that doesn't tell you very much of practical value. And that's something that's only been done very recently. So typically, just throw somebody down in Japan and in that person's lifetime, it is unlikely that that person will experience a very large devastating earthquake. Every three generations or so, it is likely that somebody is going to experience a large devastating earthquake. So there's enough earthquakes that there is a useful earthquake lore that develops in terms of if the earth shakes, run to high ground. If the earth shakes, avoid these kind of areas. Expect the possibility of this or that. But on the other hand, it's not so frequent that that people are always current about this knowledge, especially in the modern era. Mm. So, and then it just so happens that after World War II, there was a period of about 50 years of remarkable quiescence in the earth, where there just weren't that many important earthquakes happening or tsunami until 1995 in Kobe. So there was also this period in more recently when people thought, oh, modern science is doing amazing things. Imagine the 1950s and 60s and rockets are going to the moon. And I'm sure that those seismologists are busy figuring out how to predict earthquakes. And they'll be able to tell us when one's coming and we can get out of there. And it's a long and complicated story, but they were actually getting money to do that from the government. But of course, no one could do that. So 1995 was quite a shock to many people in Japan, and there was a shift from spending resources trying to predict earthquakes, which is essentially impossible. I mean, in the most abstract theory, maybe someday it will become possible, but it isn't possible now, to anti-seismic engineering in construction. And that's been going on since the 1990s. In a very big way. And the big earthquake in 2011 really showed the effectiveness of that, as those, you've probably seen images of those tall buildings in Tokyo swaying back and forth. And essentially because there are shock absorbers in the foundation. So that's been the focus since the 1990s.
Now, in your opinion, how should all of us be prepared for this inevitable and unpredictable event? Do you have any top tips?
Okay, I might not be the perfect person to ask for that because, you know, it's so if I'm living in Japan, and you'll even in a hotel or something, there will often be a hard hat helmet in the closet and a waterproof flashlight, things like that. So just at a personal level, most people in Japan know to keep those kinds of items at hand, as well as water and non-perishable food and things like that. So I think people in Japan are very good at that. They've been instructed, you know, what to do. And there are, you know, of course, common sense things like standing in doorways if you can't get out of a building, you know, making automatic gas shutoffs and so forth. But if you don't have that, then, you know, go run and turn off the gas. You know, those sort of common sense things. Now, in Japan, it's amazing the extent to which a lot of this is now built in for you know, so the trains will stop running on the Shinkansen, for example. They can sense the movement of the earth faster than a human can detect it and immediately shut down, even before the people on the train realize an earthquake is happening. And that happened in 2011, and it worked great. I think only one train was derailed. And even that was, there were no fatalities or anything. And so, you know, there's a lot of stuff that's built in on people's phones. There will be an earthquake warning. Now, you know, you can't really warn before it happens, but just as soon as it happens, an earthquake is happening. So that maybe if you're a little bit further away and you're just starting to feel the shaking, you'll have a little bit of extra warning. And then a tsunami warning is actually practical.
So at the end of the day, we ask all of our guest experts this question. If you had to pick one person or thing, it could be a concept that you think is to blame for the massive destruction and the loss of life caused by the Great Kanto earthquake, who or what would that be?
A person or a concept? All right. yeah, I mean, there's actually, just real briefly, there was a kind of right after the earthquake, people blamed a particular individual. I don't think he deserves necessarily to be blamed. Omori Fusakichi, who is a seismologist. And Omori's view was we shouldn't alarm people about earthquakes. So, you know, he would tend to err on the side of caution about the possibility of an earthquake hitting Tokyo. I think his view was reasonable, but complacency in broadly defined, you know, to include the kind of a sort of momentum or laziness in which you say, yes, there are all these dangers out there and, we'll, you know, they're on our list to deal with, like, say, if you're a city official or something. But that was really one of the factors that caused a great deal of loss of life, complacency. An earthquake might happen, and we've got gas lines all over the place and too much wooden construction and so forth. But, you know, no one person is in a position to change all that. So that really came to a head. I've seen newspaper articles as early as the 1890s warning about exactly this sort of thing happening in Tokyo if an earthquake happens. So the warnings were out there, but society chose not to heed them.
Well, that's a lot to think about. And thank you so much, Greg, for helping us understand this terrible tragedy.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me on. And good luck with all of your endeavors.
Thank you. You too.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen,
premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
With us today, we have producer Clayton Early.
Hello.
And fact checker Chris Smith.
Hi.
I love talking to experts.
Yes.
I just... could do it all day.
Yeah.
So many great points that Greg had about this, you know, terrible tragedy. I mean, just the describing of what it was like right after the shock, the terrible death toll and how those people perished in, we need to clarify, not a department store.
No.
A depot. Because I think we got a little confused and we did discuss... How much we didn't like department stores.
Yeah, so you're off the hook this time, Macy's.
Sorry, department stores. But
in describing that, he also talked about how there just weren't many open areas around the city and how the city was constructed so quickly and it grew so quickly that, and going back to his sort of final decision about complacency, the city builders or the people in charge didn't care to create these parks or these spaces, in the original, I guess, version.
Well, who plans for, who does, like, what city planner is thinking about fire tornadoes too? You know, it's like, it makes sense that people would go to the one open area because there's fires within like a minute of this earthquake. But how it kind of reminded me of, you know, the funicular disaster where everyone ran up the track instead of down the track away from the smoke. It's like your instincts either fail you or really help you out in that desperate moment.
Right.
Yes, exactly.
It makes you appreciate all the parks around your... I immediately started thinking about all the parks in my neighborhood.
Yeah.
And how, quickly I should probably run to them and... how grateful I am that they're there.
And you guys are going to the Rose Bowl if everyone recalls.
That's right. Another large park. But even just the little parks in our zone, you know?
But those are decisions, to Greg's point, those are decisions that city builders make, and to deprive certain communities of those environments or parks and stuff is, you know, that's, those are just decisions.
Like
those
are, and it makes me think of like that.
Doesn't happen randomly.
How, you know, that is a political decision, when budgets and when it comes to like urban areas and the push to create more parks and open spaces, it's like all of a sudden, it's not just for recreation, it's actually a very...
There's a public health reason for it.
Yeah. So he also talked about the anxiety of modernity that was happening at the time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he also discussed... what else? There was so much.
Yeah.
The fire bombing of Tokyo. I'm like, do we need to do an episode on this?
And
things were exploding? Because this sounds insane to me.
Yes. How do we not know about this? I mean... let's mark that down. We'll have to go back to that. But he was saying...
Well, we covered...
Hiroshima.
We covered the nuclear bombs, but we didn't cover the firebombings.
Yeah. Sounds absolutely terrible. When he was describing the tar melting and people getting stuck in... What a nightmare.
Yeah.
It makes sense why, like suddenly like an event like this makes like it makes sense why what's his name? The giant Godzilla.
Uh-huh. Did not
Do you know what I mean?
Realize
not
that's expecting. What you were gonna say, but okay.
It makes sense why like they would had like have this like history about Godzilla, this like epic scary disaster, because they that seems like that part of the world has just experienced like really epic catastrophe.
Epic disasters. So
that's like that's a monster's embodiment of that struggle.
Interesting.
Wow. For sure. Absolutely.
Can you guys describe, because he was talking at a certain point, and I didn't see the video, about the plate tectonics, and what were his hands doing when he said it was like the plates were doing this?
Okay, so this is the best way I can describe it. You put your fingers, your hand on top of each other.
Mm-hmm. You're resting the tip of your fingers on the tips of your other fingers.
Yeah. Okay. Maybe another way you could do it. Okay. This is going to
explain. This is going to be.
Put your hand in prayer. Yeah.
And then move your arms up so that your fingertips, basically your two middle fingers are touching, and then slightly overlap them.
Yep. That's good.
And then when he said the tectonic goes like this, he said the plate or your top hand is basically, or your bottom hand is pushing up.
Pushes the top hand up so that it almost like scoops it out.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
So
it's not a shift so much as it is like a flip or like a teepee effect kind of.
It's big time. Let's just say that.
Yeah.
That's what's causing the massive shaking and tsunamis that follow.
I might do a little video and post it on our Instagram of me explaining this movement. Okay, we'll do that. So check out our Instagram for the explanation, the hand explanation.
We're not going to put any description. We're just going to post you doing that, and people will have to figure out why you're doing it.
Yeah, it'll just say, go to our episode. So listen to our episode to know what this is.
Right.
So what do we think? I feel like he blamed complacency. I mean, he
said, we end up blaming?
We ended up blaming Clayton. Please remind us.
Yes, it was my fault.
we ended up blaming Clayton.
Clayton.
We
ended up blaming location.
Location, location, location in jail.
Which we knew might change based on the expert.
That might backfire on us.
And we gave the earthquake of humanity the big slap, which had to do with more of like...
Right, because, and just to circle back to that horrific aftermath that Greg mentioned, 6,000 is the rough estimate of people's whose lives, innocent people whose lives were lost, including Chinese or anybody who couldn't pull off the local Tokyo accent.
Yes,
which was
people
crazy
with speech impediments. Oh my God.
That's just crazy to me. So that I think we can keep in as the big slap, which is just, hey, geez, I know this is hard to understand, but... But in terms of, do you want to keep it as location, location, location?
I think complacency is a little better, actually. I mean, I understand why location, location, location is important. And because of the location, I think it's important not to be complacent, right? So I in a way, I feel like we can fold in location, location, location to complacency, right? Because... Mm-hmm.
You can't,
it's not
you
so much the location
house.
As much as the, yeah.
Right.
You need to be aware and you have to have a plan. And this, and you mentioned this, Clayton, during the episode, but it is a reminder of how important maintenance is. Mm-hmm. And you know, how many times are you sometimes in school or wherever and you have to do another drill, right? And you're just like annoyed that you're doing a drill. But really... You shouldn't be. It's a really good reminder of getting it in your body, knowing what to do when a disaster strikes, so that it's just, you know, inherently where to go.
Mm-hmm.
Right. The shock of those moments, whatever it is so real and something that you just will never be able to plan for, that the sheer repetition of this planning and, you know, preparation, hopefully comes to you sooner, because there will be the moment of, oh my gosh, what do I do?
Yes.
And then hopefully that repetition is what you're like, thankfully I've planned for this.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So keep your sneakers in the car. Remember where, hard hats. Didn't think about that. I guess
about those. And get me an LA app. Get me an LA earthquake app that tells us when an earthquake is happening. It probably is one already, right?
Yes, there is one. I got you. I think there's several.
I have one on my phone, but you should get it too, Chris, because we don't know if we'll be together if and when this strikes.
Jeez, don't make me think about that. I don't even like when you go to work. I don't want to have to think about that.
Yeah, pretty soon he's going to say he doesn't like my short haircut.
Oh, I love your short haircut. That's why I don't like when you leave.
Cause an earthquake because it's so hot.
No, I just thought it was funny. Yes, because it's so hot. But also Greg was talking about how society was up in arms because the women were cutting their hair short.
And you just cut your hair short. I was laughing about that. Rebecca, you're going to cause an earthquake. Grow your hair out.
I think I should call it complacency. You're going to the alarmist jail. Now, important, please. This is a good time and a good reminder to review your checklist. Make sure you have your water at home, all of your supplies, batteries, flashlights, maps. Get your paper maps in order and prepare, because you just never know.
Absolutely.
You never know. And also, this is also a good time to rate review.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
View and subscribe. Mm-hmm. Because we're helping you. We're helping remind you not only to, help us grow this podcast, but we're helping remind you of the things to do.
We're giving you actual practical advice for
that's what I was going for. Yeah, stay alive.
Think of it this way. It may be the last chance that you have to leave that review, because
yeah, it's true. Jeez, Clayton.
But why, like, seriously, just we need to raise these ratings we have on Apple Podcasts, and we need to keep growing and spreading the word so that we can continue to do these episodes. So we really appreciate it, and we need you. Now, tune in next week, because we're going to be discussing Cinco de Mayo.
Earios.
Powered by Acast.